So I know you think that I craft the service each week. Really, I sort of encounter the service, and we work together to figure out how it's going to end up. And I had in the order of service readings old and new, because I figured on the subject of conscience, I'd probably find something biblical to say, or some other ancient source to show that people have been worrying about this forever, and then something very modern to juxtapose to it. And as the service came together, the readings got more and more compressed until we have something that's sort of old and something that's almost as old as our readings. The James Russell Lowell poem is from 1845, before the Civil War. Lowell was a radical abolitionist, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that. It's a very, very long poem. Two of our hymns are based on it. Once to Every Soul and Nation, and what was the other one I showed you? Anyway, there's language from this poem in two of our hymns. And the W.E.B. Du Bois was written over a century ago, 1907, his response to how to sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee. He was just beginning to become famous as one of the leaders of African-American thought in this country at that time. So those were some heavy, historically important readings, and the more background you have about them, the heavier they get. But I want to start my reflection on conscience today talking about Pinocchio. Now, most of us know Pinocchio from the Walt Disney animated film of the same name, which was originally released in 1940. It got overshadowed by the start of World War II, and didn't become really famous, actually, till after the war, even though it was revolutionary in terms of its animation. Pinocchio is a carved wooden marionette in the shape of a boy, and Pinocchio is brought to life by the Blue Fairy after the old woodcarver Geppetto wishes upon a star that his marionette could be a real boy. A true human with literally no strings attached but those of mutual love. Now, once he's alive, Pinocchio wants that too, but he's still a marionette. And one thing that he's missing is a conscience. So the Blue Fairy appoints a cricket who happens to be watching over this transformation into a live marionette, Jiminy Cricket, to be Pinocchio's conscience, or to give the full title that the Blue Fairy assigns, Pinocchio's conscience, Lord High Keeper of the Knowledge of Right and Wrong, Counselor in Moments of High Temptation, and Guide along the Straight and Narrow Path. Well, Jiminy swells up to his new job, and he sets out to explain to Pinocchio what's going on. He says, the world is full of temptations. They're the wrong things that seem right at the time, and the right things might seem wrong sometimes, or sometimes the wrong things may be right, but they're at the wrong time, or vice versa. Do you understand? Pinocchio goes, no. So seeing his bafflement, Jiminy Cricket resorts to song, the song Always Let Your Conscience Be Your Guide. So Poppy could sing the title lyric when she and I were chatting about it this week, but neither of us could remember any of the verses. Advice like, it's a straight and narrow path, and if you start to slide, give a little whistle, yoo-hoo, give a little whistle, woo-hoo, and always let your conscience be your guide. Don't worry, I know when to stop. Pinocchio has to demonstrate bravery, honesty, and selflessness before he can become human. Now, he repeatedly falls prey to temptation, and eventually, he and Geppetto, both worse for the wear, do achieve their shared dream, and the Blue Fairy gives Jiminy Cricket a gold star for his work as Pinocchio's initial conscience. So how does this work for you as a way to think about conscience? The UU fifth principle says that we promote it as a basic human right. It's not ours from birth, like the inherent worth and dignity we affirm in our first principle. We are introduced to it by others as we seek meaning in our early life experiences. And somehow, somehow it's linked to bravery, honesty, and selflessness. That's not a bad starting point, but in the course of my research, because I saw this movie when I was a kid and did not remember many of the details, I also learned about the original fairy tale, which was serialized in an Italian children's magazine from 1881 to 1883. And it turns out that the original story has a much more complicated view of honesty. In the original story, Pinocchio becomes human in the end simply because he shows himself through his trials to be good-hearted in an age-appropriate way, not because he becomes some Disney role model of the perfect boy. I thought. Now that feels closer to my main message for today. Conscience isn't about saintliness or heroics. It's about the diverse ways that we, to use the words of Apal Davies, use our lives to grow a soul. We are taught what the world around us regards as right and wrong as we mature, and it's maybe a special category of what you might call socially appropriate behavior. We eventually develop our own internal grasp of what is truthful about those teachings of right and wrong, what we really think is true, and that is conscience at its core. Now, many of us sense conscience as a voice within an intensely emotional private language for communicating with us. Some people sense it as a conduit for instructions from God. I would put it more generally, if I'm going to use spiritual language, I would say that we're connecting with the will and power of what Abraham Lincoln called our better angels when we heed our conscience. Now, Benjamin Franklin once called a good conscience continual Christmas. It's not as cheerful as it sounds, though, when you think about it. The Christmas birth story is the first step toward eventual rebellion against an unjust social order and crucifixion for Jesus. A troubled conscience is no bed of roses, but a life spent maintaining a clear conscience has its own stresses. There's a story about a mother who carefully explained the difference between conscious, C-O-N-S-C-I-O-U-S, and conscience to her child, and then asked if she had been clear, only to get the response, "Sure, conscious is when you are aware of something, and conscience is when you wish you weren't." Now, the truth in that comes from the close and frequent connection between conscience and justice. The Unitarian minister Theodore Parker saw it this way: as truth is the side of God turned towards the intellect, so is justice the side of him which conscience looks upon. Conscience calls us out of our comfort zones, as James Russell Lowell did in the present crisis. And so did the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in speeches and sermons like this anti-Vietnam War talk not long before he was killed. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it expedient? And then expedience comes along and asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? Conscience asks the question, is it right? There comes a time when one must take the position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but must do it because conscience tells him it is right. My point in summoning these great figures on the heels of Pinocchio is that the right of conscience is featured in our fifth principle because our ability to exercise it so often defines our relationship to the great challenges of our times. We saw it recently in the voting on the impeachment. But I want to make sure that we don't limit our regard for conscience to the times when the stakes are so high. Like the original Pinocchio, we are not naturally conscientious. The more essential we believe developing a conscience is to our humanity, the more humble we need to be about how we respond to its call. Our conscience, even when mature, doesn't magically escape narrow-mindedness. Lowell deserves to be honored for his passionate call to the struggle to abolish slavery in 1845, when that was still an unpopular position. But we rightfully cringe when it builds towards a climax grounded in hero worship of his pilgrim ancestors. and I had Jason read only one stanza out of the five or six involved in how highly he thought of the Pilgrims. And in fact, Lowell's anti-slavery stance did not, of course, understand the white supremacist aspects of his ancestors' treatment of the indigenous people. And Lowell, like many of the abolitionists, also had a deep-seated belief that black people were inferior to European settlers in intelligence and other ways, even though they should not be slaves. The conscience of James Russell Lowell is an ambiguous heritage for us. It spotlights why critics warn that claims to freedom of conscience, when someone is telling you they have a right to what they're saying because of freedom of conscience, that freedom includes the right to act on the basis of conscience, but it often short circuits the use of reason and the admission to the discussion of competing arguments. Standing on the right of conscience is saying there are no other arguments that I'm willing to hear. No wonder we Unitarian Universalists hitch our affirmation of it to the use of democratic decision making in the same principle, the same fifth principle. It's kind of a check and balance principle. Lowell's poem, for all its grandeur, seems less real to me than the act of conscience embodied in W.E.B. Du Bois' revised version of My Country, Tis of Thee. This small, almost private act of subversion. Remember, he tells you, if you just sing it this way, hardly anyone will notice. Speaks of values all people of goodwill should embrace. But the language centers on the experience of marginalized people so clearly that white folk must be just a little bit uncomfortable singing these lyrics. For blacks, indigenous people, and other people of color, maybe they were just that uncomfortable singing the original lyrics. The original words. Still, I wonder how many white people of Du Bois' time or ours get beyond the general discomfort to catch on to how specifically he's expressing outrage against lynching. There's an unbearable irony, I confess, that I initially missed in his heart's purpose to rise, and he puts the rise, word rise in italics, his heart's purpose to rise above all hate and chill, hate that chills. And it's immediately followed by the next verse, let laments swell the breeze and ring from all the trees, sweet freedom's song. This is a direct protest against lynching. Think for a minute how urgent the traditional closing words of the hymn, protect us by thy might, great God our King, sound to black folk at the end of W.B. Du Bois' version. Now, my original intent in this sermon was to leave ample time to introduce you to Granny Weatherwax, a renowned resident of a planet called Discworld, invented by the late British writer Terry Pratchett, as a setting where he could satirize countless aspects of human history and modern life. Granny lives in a remote district of the Discworld called Lanker, where magic lies heavy on the landscape and witches have long been prominent. Now, Lanker is no paradise. The winter winds are described by Pratchett as lazy in the sense that they blow right through everybody because they're too lazy to go around them or around anything else. Granny is close to pure conscience. She's not always nice, but she is always on the side of right. She's not concerned with what anyone wants, but is instinctively in touch with what is needed for a just outcome. She is subversive, not by choice, but by nature, stepping into any situation where her gut tells her, I can't be having with that. While she is quite capable of casting spells and curses, she prefers to work in tune with nature and rely on psychology, or as she calls it, headology. In one case, rather than lighting a fire, she stares at a log so long that it becomes embarrassed enough by the tension to burst in flames. Troublesome characters can often be dealt with by hinting that she has cursed them. Sooner or later, something bad happens that they attribute to the curse she hasn't actually put into place, and they flee her presence. Now, Granny belongs in the company of others inhabiting this sermon because the scale or visibility of doing the right thing is never an issue for her. There may be times when that can be a helpful way, I think, for us to think about conscience as a congregation. It's not only how we respond to the great challenges of our days. In fact, it might not even be mainly about how we respond to the great challenges of our days. Take our recent participation in the Charterhouse lunch. A chicken dish was on the menu. Our cooks were notified as a helpful hint that chicken was on sale that week at Hannaford's. But my wife Michelle has for a long time made a point of buying chicken from local organic farmers she's met at the farmers market, either directly or through the co-op. And she told me, "I'm not getting what I'm cooking at Hannaford's because it doesn't feel right to give the guests at Charterhouse something different from what I give us." So how does this relate to that fifth principle calling on us to affirm and promote the right of conscience as a congregation? Remember, the principles apply to us collectively. You don't have to ascribe to any of them as an individual to be a UU. Well, Michelle and I are fortunate enough not to need reimbursement for an occasional contribution like this to the Charterhouse meals. But what she said made me think that CVUUS might want to work collectively on paying for food we feel good about serving ourselves and others. It won't necessarily make the meal tastier, but it might enlarge the spiritual sphere of what is right about that meal. Now, I'm not advocating for this particular action. I bring it up as a simple example of the countless small ways that we can discuss matters of conscience. Once the discussion has started, we can then make democratic decisions as a group about whether to amplify them into changes in congregational behavior. I spoke last week about CVUUS being a welcome table congregation, and we sang that hymn, "All Kinds of People at the Welcome Table." A place where we encourage each other to think about everything we do as feeding people in some way, physically or spiritually. Practicing the ways of being good-hearted like the original Pinocchio can help. Not being afraid to follow the call of conscience and publicly tackling the great justice issues of our day, like James Russell Lowell and Martin Luther King Jr. did, can help. Knowing history will find faults in us to which we are blind, and forgiving ourselves for that shortcoming as we think about James Russell Lowell's misplaced, unvarnished love of the pilgrims can help. Embracing the small acts of subversion that keep our connections to conscience open, as Du Bois did with his hymn, can help. And if a Granny Weatherwax appears among us, someone who just instinctively always heads for the right thing, I hope we can welcome her as a kindred, albeit scary, spirit. Blessed be, and amen.